rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Johnson, Judge Klopaki, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good afternoon. Welcome to our last case scheduled for oral argument today on our March 12 calendar. Schmidt v. Schmidt, heard by Interactive Television. Counsel, we are looking at a blank screen. In order for us to test the technology, I think we'll need each of you to go to the microphone and say a few words, and then we'll know that you are present.
It's muted on your end. We aren't able to hear you.
You can't hear us? Can you hear me now? You cannot hear me now. Speak louder. I don't think that's the problem. I'm right in front of the microphone. Hold on a moment. We're trying to... Can you hear me at all?
I can't hear anything that the court is saying.
Okay. So
they must have muted you.
We'll try to fix that.
I know you can't hear me now. My mute button's on. Correct?
All right. Well, we'll try to get it worked on. We can hear you, but you can't hear us. All right. Do you know sign language? No?
It's going to be a long oral argument.
Was anything coming through?
No. He's saying, can you read sign language?
Oh, she knows it.
Oh, okay. I thought he was signaling first down.
So we can hear them, but they can't hear us. Now he has headphones on. Does that matter?
Maybe he can't hear us because he has the headphones on.
But apparently nobody else stood up.
Can you hear us now?
I saw on the far left on the bottom, there was like
there
a
we
microphone.
Are. Now we're able to hear.
You can hear us now?
Yes.
Yes, now I can hear you.
Oh, very good. So we were on...
The question is whether you want to hear us or not.
I'll determine that after this is over.
Now, wouldn't that have been nice? You could have had your argument, and we wouldn't have been allowed to interrupt you with any questions whatsoever. How sweet is that? Now, that's modern technology. That's technology working for you. So now, are both of you present in the same facility, or are you in a different location from respondent?
We're both in Willmar.
Oh, wonderful. Perfect. And you're both present in the courtroom?
We are.
Okay, wonderful. So just repeating, the matter is Schmidt v. Schmidt. It's our last case on for oral argument today on our March 12 calendar. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument, 15 for the appellant, 15 for the respondent, with an additional 5 for the appellant's counsel if you choose to use it for rebuttal. I believe the timing restriction is indicated there on the screen, perhaps, or it will be, if not, somewhere in the podium. And if neither of those is true, then we will shout and scream when you get to 15 minutes, and you'll know your time is up. Counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument.
John Mack for appellant Schmidt. A procedural point to begin. Mr. Schmidt made a motion for new trial, and he made a motion for amended findings. However, the attorney for Mrs. Schmidt did not. And this is very important because about half the argument of respondent here is on the cross appeal. Now, I think I can deal with 3 of the 4 issues he raises on the cross appeal, but the other one I badly would have liked to have an explanation from the court or what it did, because I can't figure it out based upon the record. And of course that would have been fleshed out in a motion for new trial or a motion for amended findings. Let me start out then largely with the argument of the appellant in this case. There are many issues involved in this case, some major and some minor, and I'm gonna try to touch on the ones that I think are major. The first issue has to do with the award of the farmland. The court in this case gave approximately 69 acres to the respondent and approximately 152 acres to the appellant in this case. But I believe that two of these determinations are highly flawed. The first one is that appellant is a farmer, and there's evidence of record that he did almost all the farming and that he relied upon farming to make a living. The farm was valued at approximately $1.2 million, and the court ordered my client to pay almost $300,000 to the respondent in this case. Our question is, and why we think what the lower court did was unwise, how is he ever going to be able to pay that if he has only 152 acres to farm? That farm has been in his family long before he himself began to farm. In fact, it was either given or sold to the parties here in the course of their marriage. However, given that that's their farmland, he's a farmland, and he needs that to make a living, he should have been awarded the farmland, and then, of course, the value should have gone to his side of the ledger.
Mr. Mack?
Yes.
I'm unclear whether whether he continues to be a farmer or whether at the time of trial he intended to continue being a farmer because he sold the dairy herd and so on. And I understand there's other operations on the farm, but could you clarify that for me, please?
Yes, he did indicate that he intended to farm. He indicated that he was probably going to sell the bulk of the machinery, and I'll get into that in a moment. But he indicated that he would be milking the cows, which is a form of farming. He would be possibly renting some of that property, but would be farming some of the other. Now, let me go into a second
Was he intending then to continue planting cash crops? And at the time of trial, was he still cultivating cash crops?
Yes. Now, the second thing that I think is problematical about what the court did, although it's much less important, is that the 1 acre, let's call it Tract C, sits over by Roscoe about a mile away from Tract A, which was awarded to my client. It makes absolutely no sense to have a 1 acre tract separated from the rest of the farm. Not only is my client not going to be able to farm because it would not be profitable for going 1 mile down the road for 1 acre, but he's not going to be able to rent it either. Obviously, whoever has parcel B ought to have parcel C and have parcel C credited to the ledger of the party who ultimately gets it. It will be difficult to obtain, I submit, a loan on parcel A alone to obtain, in a case like this, enough money to pay off the wife. And my client's actual earnings now,
What was the valuation for parcel A?
Approximately $800,000, I believe.
And
that is...
And his obligation...
That is...
His obligation to the respondent is how much did you say, 300 and some?
Roughly $300,000, yes. So the question is, shouldn't he be able to get a loan on that? That's going to be difficult because a bank looks at two things. It looks at the value of the land and it looks upon his earning power. And his earning power, since he can't farm and since he can't do other things with that land, is about $3,000 a month. There is no way he's going to be able to pay off a $300,000 loan unless, of course, he sells some of the farm, which is precisely what he doesn't want to do. I want to move on to the second issue here.
Because he doesn't want to do it, he may not have much of a choice.
Well, if this order stands, yes. But that's precisely the issue. It isn't just that he doesn't want to do it. It's that if he does it, he's breaking up a family farm. He's making it impossible to do a few things with the farm that he can do. So, of course, just because he doesn't want to do it doesn't mean that he can't be forced to do it. I'm saying he should not be forced to do it. Now, moving on to the issue of the sale of the farm machinery, the parties had agreed to sell it, and I think that's undisputed. The problem is that the court took it upon itself to say, well, this will not get, the auction will not be held. That's quite simply not rational. And the reason it isn't rational is because the parties still were attempting to arrange the auction, and the fact that the auction happens after the marriage is dissolved is irrelevant. The court can still order that the auction be held and that the proceeds be split evenly. But what happened here is that the court credited all the machinery to my client, and one of the things that it did not do is take into consideration the tax consequences of my client having to sell the farm machinery. Now, if my client had had all the farm machinery, it's possible, although he wouldn't have wanted to do it, that he would have been able to use some of the machinery at least to avoid the recapture of capital gains. But that didn't happen.
Mr. Matt, can you be more specific about the capital gains, the extent of them, and was this in the record?
I don't think it was in the record, except that it was raised. And my client, of course, doesn't know exactly, but it can be roughly figured by taking a look at the capital gains law. And my client figures it would be about $20,000 to $25,000 in capital gains on the machinery if he'd had to sell it alone.
Were the tax returns admitted into evidence?
Were the tax returns in evidence? I believe they were.
So those returns will show depreciation schedules and show basis for
right.
for this property? And
it should, yes. Now I want to turn to the arguments made by Mr. Glenn's. As I say, he didn't file a motion for a new trial, but it's pretty clear that three of the four things that are being talked about are the sorts of things that the court could reasonably make a determination. The proceeds of the life insurance policy, remember, the judge said that that the amount actually realized should in fact be given to my client, but that my client immediately put $50,000 of it in the bank to count toward paying off his wife. That's a rational kind of thing to do. And that's the kind of thing that a motion for a new trial is important on, because the court can spell out in its determination in the new trial motion that that's what it intended to do and why it was intending to do that. The second part is one where I'll frankly indicate I can't figure out what happened. This is the $28,000 that the respondent is indicating was double counted. Well, maybe it was, or maybe the court meant that to be something in compensation for something else that my client gave up. For example, perhaps it could be credited toward his tax burden. We don't know it. Now, if we had the opportunity to have heard the judge after the motion was made, we would have some idea whether the judge was just plain wrong or whether he was trying to equalize something. The court erred in reducing the value of the CMCU checking account.
So I'm not sure if I understand your argument. You're acknowledging that basis of the cross appeal is one to which you do not have a clear legal argument in response.
That's right. I wish I did, but I was scratching my head. The court doesn't indicate anywhere in its findings what was going on, and that's why I say if we had a motion for new trial or amended findings, perhaps we would know. With regard to the checking account, it seems to me that the court pretty much took care of this. My client had the right under Rule 54 and 59 to present evidence that had not been presented at trial if it could reasonably not could if it could not reasonably have been brought to the court's attention. The court seemed to think, and the court has the discretion to find, that this was, in fact, evidence that could not have been brought at trial, and therefore, the court was in a position to grant it. Now, the respondent, as far as I can tell, isn't saying that the court was wrong or irrational. A procedural argument is being made, and when a procedural argument like this is being made and is within the discretion of the lower court, it should be assumed that the lower court is correct. The last thing which is brought up is, I think, a fairly weak point. The bill of sale for $1 wasn't, in fact, a gift. Seems to me that the court could look beyond the mere form of the transaction and say it's perfectly obvious what the donor intended to do in a case like this. The donor intended to give it to my client. So for that reason, it seems to me that all four of the requests made by the respondent in this case should be denied. Now,
Mr. Mack, there's an argument, I think, at page 4 of the red brief having to do with the 2017 corn crop, which I think had a value, at least respondent cross-appellant asserts it had a value of $40,000, which seems, I think the argument is it's left unaccounted for and your client was in possession of it. Can you respond to that, please?
Yeah. First of all, my client says that the amount that's in his possession is, in fact, a good deal less than the amount claimed. Secondly, it seems to me that this is one more example of something where we needed a motion for new trial. It seems to me that my client, in fact, made a showing of how much cattle he had and how much corn, and that the amount attributed to him may very well have been something by the court to compensate for something on her side. We don't know. More questions?
It appears not.
I have a question about the, I'm sorry, Judge Ross, I have a question about the additional expenditures from the checking account that were added in the post-trial motions. When that evidence was offered by your client, and I understand he had different counsel, was it offered under the rules 54, 59? You know, was it expressly, was the argument expressly made that this was evidence that could not have been offered earlier?
That's a good question, but since the only basis for the court's doing what it did is that that was argued before the court, I have to assume that what ought to have been done was in fact done.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal time. Counsel for respondent.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you. I'm Eric Glenz on behalf of Deborah Schmidt, respondent in this appeal. May it please the court. This is a farm dissolution case in which there are several issues. You've heard issues from appellant, and respondent has issues as well. Now, it seems, first of all, I'd like to just address the question of whether or not my client, it seems to be, there's an argument being made that my client needed to file a motion for a new trial or amended findings, and that just simply isn't the case. The appellant did file a motion for new trial, and my client filed a notice of related appeal and has the right to appeal the orders, in this case under Rule 106. And the appeals case of Kostelnik versus Kostelnik stated that Rule 106 is not conditioned on the order being appealable to the respondent independently, as they are forced to participate in this appeal, and it is in the interest of judicial efficiency for this appeal to be heard. I think maybe what appellant is saying is that this is trying to apply the Sauter rule, which says that matters such as trial procedure, jury instructions, evidentiary rulings, those things are only subject to appellate reveal if a motion for new trial has been made. That's just not the case here. Again, supporting my position is Alpha Real Estate versus Delta Dental. That case stated that the Sauter rule does not apply to substantive questions of law that were properly raised during trial. All of respondents' issues here today were raised at trial and are properly before this court. To first respond to appellants' issues, to start off with the tax consequences of the machinery, the trial court did not order him to sell this machinery. Considering any tax consequences would be speculative at best. The appellant admitted under cross-examination that there was an agreement to sell before trial. In fact, the trial was actually delayed a month so that this auction could be set up. He admitted in his testimony that he had control of the machinery and cattle and that he didn't sell it. This is all in the transcript on page 214. That's contained in my brief. He also wrote in his pre-hearing statement that a machinery auction was going to be held, the machinery would be sold at the next consignment sale. That would have been before the trial. That did not occur. The court in this case wasn't clear whether or not the appellant was ever going to sell this property. And there was no evidence offered relating to the tax consequences. It wasn't even brought up. The brief even states that there could be a capital loss. And this just highlights the speculative nature of this. If the appellant doesn't even know what the capital gains tax is, how is the court supposed to make that calculation? And this is both supported by Maurer versus Maurer and Salstrom v. Salstrom. In regards to Tract B, that is the roughly 70-acre parcel that was awarded to my client. This isn't a case where, in a typical farm divorce, where one party was the only farmer and the other one worked off the farm or was a homemaker. In this case, and the record shows, that my client was actually the dairy farmer. She was the one who milked the cattle throughout the entire marriage.
Well, is there a barn and milking facility on this 80 acres that she has?
Nope. No, there is not. But she testified that she needed that 70 acres so that she could continue making a living. It would provide her with a rental income moving forward, and she still has ties to that land. She had been on that land for 30 years as well. And they're also, in regards to the dairy operation, she was forced, in essence, to leave the farm, and they sold the dairy cattle because nobody was going to continue dairy farming. He wanted to stay on the farm site, and they made the joint decision to sell the cattle. They did that together. So he was never going to continue farming either. Now, his argument that he should be awarded Tract B is really self-defeating.
I'm sorry,
in that
he doesn't plan to grain farm?
To be honest, I'm not entirely certain whether or not he is or not. At times, he said during this process that he was going to get a different job. So that's not entirely sure. But again, my client also needed that land to make a living as well. She had no real good source of income either. She had been farming for 30 years. Now, as I'm saying this, his request to be awarded this land is nonsensical in that he's asking for an additional $300,000 to be moved over to his side of the ledger when, and just for clarification, he was ordered to pay $425,000 to my client without that property being ordered to him. So suddenly he would have to come up with $725,000 to pay my client. If a bank's not going to give him $425,000, why would he suddenly get $725,000? That simply doesn't make any sense. Now, as far as the homestead being non-marital, this is in the, I don't think he argued this today, but in his brief, appellant says that the homestead was significantly non-marital and the court made an error by not acknowledging that. However, this was sold to them on a contract for deed with both parties. There was never an attempt to document a gift at the time. That would be very simple to do. Gift tax return would have been a simple option. The discount was more likely an acknowledgement of payments made under the farm lease agreement. This farm lease agreement was 8 years prior, I believe, in which respondent testified was a lease to own. Installment payments, and there was installment payments in this lease, and there was also testimony that the contract for deed that they executed was a percentage point less in interest than the lease. Again, why was there? Why would there be interest rate attached to a lease? Again, just highlighting the fact that the contract for deed wasn't actually the time when the sale occurred. It was really just an acknowledgement of the farm lease agreement payments. Back 8 years prior to the contract for deed, appellant filled out some life insurance policies where he claimed to own $200,000 worth of property on both his parents' life insurance policies. So he was already claiming that he owned this real estate, which just highlights that real estate or that farm lease agreement was really just a lease to own. The court properly determined that this was not a gift to appellant. This was simply a reduction in purchase price based on the fact that they had made lease payments during the marriage for the 8 years prior. And finally, the appellant is asking for a new trial or amended findings because of errors. I'm not really sure of what errors he's referring to, and there was no case law cited in that brief regarding that. But from what I can tell, apparently he wants a new trial simply because he can't pay the $400,000 equalization payment, but yet wants to be awarded an additional $300,000, which goes against logic. Now, in regards to my client's issues, the life insurance proceeds, first of all, is probably the biggest issue in regards to the respondent. This life insurance policy was paid for with all marital funds, and it was taken out on appellant's mother. Now, the court determined that it was marital, which is the correct determination, but used a valuation of $40,000 on a valuation date of September 1st, and she passed away 22 days later. That value became $100,000. Now, both WPATA versus WPATA and Minnesota Statute 518.58 Subdivision 3 support respondents' claim that the proper value for the division of marital property would be $100,000. I know the statute I referenced is in regards to a sale of marital property, but in essence, this is the same thing. It's a marital property turned into cash during the process of dissolution. This policy became $100,000 6 months prior to the divorce. There was no non-marital component to it. And by valuing it at $40,000 for division purposes, but awarding it to him in which he got $100,000, in essence, the court gave him a $60,000 non-marital windfall. And that is a clear error. Now, in regards to, in my argument, there's a pre-hearing statement of value, which the court, in its scheduling order, required pre-trial disclosure of values, which shall be conclusive of that party's position. Now, both parties submitted values of $40,000 for crops and $50,000 for cattle. But the court decided the crops were equitably divided, essentially using a zero for the value of crops in the final order. The problem is that appellant had all the 2017 corn stored, and he also acknowledged in the pretrial statement that there was $40,000 worth of crops. So using zero doesn't make any sense, and it's a clear error of the law. Additionally, respondent did have a bank account balance of roughly $27,000 or $28,000, which was only from the sale of crops. Now, the court, essentially, my argument was that it double counted it, because if the court says that the crops are divided, that value in her bank account was zero, because the only money she had was from the sale of prior year's crops, 2016. He still had 2017 corn stored, and the court should have used essentially agreed upon value of $40,000.
Yeah, you said that the amounts in the financial disclosure should be conclusive, but what's the authority for that?
Well, that's what the scheduling order said. The judge said that they required a submission of pre-hearing statements and evaluations, and I quote, said, shall be conclusive of the party's position. And when we're talking about, my client maintained that through the trial. Appellant did try to come up with other numbers, but why should he be able to change the numbers when he's already submitted to the court and the court said whatever you submit is conclusive? Those are the values that should be used. Same thing goes for the cattle. The court used $10,000 when the parties both submitted $50,000. There's some disagreement on how many cattle were remaining, but the court found that 50 head of cattle were remaining. And using the appellant's own exhibit, the value of the range for those cattle would be $600 to $1,000 per head. So the range would be $30,000, $50,000. if you just do the math. So the 10,000 is just a clear error. The evidence doesn't support the findings or the conclusion. Now, now as far as the post-trial reduction of value, the court partially granted the appellant's post-trial motion to reduce his checking account by $11,273. This was done with new evidence that was never presented at trial. It was not submitted pursuant to any specific Rule 54, as you mentioned. There was no documentation of the payments. It was strictly just a handwritten list of bills that he claimed were marital. And clearly this is inappropriate to consider under Zander v. Zander. This is new evidence that was not presented at trial. Now, as far as the bill or gift or bill of sale for the machinery, the farm machinery was not a gift. It should have been called a gift instead of a bill of sale and evidence with a gift tax return. This is also just a documentation of what they had purchased from appellant's parents. Appellant even admitted at trial that his parents sold him the farm machinery. He didn't say gave me the farm machinery. He said sold me the farm machinery. And that the bill of sale isn't even an accurate representation of what was on the farm at the time the bill of sale was executed. It was just the machinery that was in this bill of sale was the same list of machinery that was on the farm lease 8 years prior. And on that farm lease, which I mentioned had installment payments and interest rate associated with it, was really a lease to purchase. This bill of sale was just done to document what had been previously purchased. The machinery was also used as collateral by the parties, as shown in evidence by a UCC financing agreement 7 years prior to the bill of sale. So they were already acting as the owners long before this bill of sale.
You made reference to gift tax, or that there was no gift tax. Is that clear in the record that no gift tax return was filed?
Well, I mean, his parents didn't testify. There was no testimony or any submission of a gift tax return. It seems like that would be a simple way to have cleared this up, but no evidence was offered to show that it was a gift.
So we don't know either way whether a gift tax return was filed?
Correct. Okay. Yep. Now, in conclusion, I'm asking the court today to deny the appellant's request for amending findings or a new trial. There just simply is no reason for it. I would ask that this court grant the respondent's request and remand with specific instructions to value the life insurance policy at $100,000 since it was a marital asset. This is a clear error to value it at $40,000. Value the crops at $40,000 and the cattle at $50,000. And disregard respondents' bank account balances since they represented the previous crop sales from 2016 crops. Reverse the post-trial reduction of appellant's bank account because it improperly considered evidence not presented at trial, and include an additional $80,790 worth of machinery in the marital property calculation, as the bill of sale was not a non-marital gift to appellant alone. Any questions?
It appears not.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for your argument. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. A farm
and again,
marital...
Just for the record, since we have an audio, we keep track of our audio presentations, if you just state your name with each leg of the argument so we can keep track of who's attached
sure.
to which one.
John Mack for appellant.
Thank you.
A farm divorce, especially if the farm is worth more than $1 million, is sort of a Rube Goldberg device. If you change one figure, it impacts another. And if you're trying to be roughly equal and make a determination that $80,000 should have gone to the other side of the ledger, then it disrupts determinations that the court has made with regard to other matters. It seems to me that the worst suggestion that counsel for respondent made is that this matter be remanded to the district court for determination of his issues, but not of the appellants. Obviously, if this is going to be done, there would be great unfairness to the appellant, who undoubtedly would have some compensation for the things that the court was going to do. But it does seem to me that if there is any kind of motion for new trial, which is granted by the plaintiff, or excuse me, the petitioner, that this court, the Court of Appeals, shouldn't be doing the calculations. Many of the things that my colleague indicated to this court are going to require calculations. What was the value? For example, I think one of the things he said is the value would be somewhere between $30,000 and $50,000. How is this court in a position to make a determination like this? Either there should be a new trial for everyone, or there should be a new trial for no one. And the motions that were made by my former colleague should be granted. Now, Mr. Glentz pointed out an interesting thing. He claims that he does not have to make a motion for new trial or for amended findings in order to preserve the record, provided it is the other side that appeals. I don't see anything in the law of the state of Minnesota or the cases that would back that up. It would be disastrous because, again, that would point out that one could simply rely on the other side to do all the findings and that one doesn't have a record below to indicate why this court should grant the relief that the respondent is seeking. Now, there are a couple of problems, I think, with what Mr. Glenn said. He said that the court did not order my client to sell the machinery. Of course it didn't, but what is my client supposed to do? He doesn't have enough land to make it valuable for him to use the machinery. And if the machinery just sits there and rusts, it's going to be a bigger loss even than if he tries to sell it. So, of course, in fact, the court made him sell it. Now, it's pretty clear that the only thing that the respondent intends to do with the property is rent it. For one thing, she said so. For two things, she has health problems. For three things, according to the kinds of things that she did on the farm, like milking cows, are not related to running a tractor over a field. So it's pretty clear that she has an intention only to rent it. Now, with regard to the issue of the relative values in a case like this, if my client were in a position to mortgage 69 plus 152, he would be in a much better position to obtain bank financing than if he had basically insufficient land to farm with 152 acres. So the logic is there. Again, we have to figure out what a bank would think like, and that's the kind of thing that would require a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you to both counsel, Mr. Mack, Mr. Glenn, for your argument and your briefing. The matter is submitted. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you. And that is the last thank case you. On our oral calendar for today. We are in recess.
All rise.